Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the news, we hear about conflict and crisis across the world all the time. Yet what we do not focus on enough are the people whose lives are upended by those conflicts. Perhaps it's because in too many big Western democracies, in my country in Australia, and in places like the United Kingdom, which we're going to talk about today, our governments are increasingly failing those who seek our help as asylum seekers or refugees. But in the space of government failure, what we have seen is the emergence of creative compassion in the community. At times, this kind of work has been led by people who've sought asylum themselves, and they've created organisations that seek to make a difference. Today's Changemaker Chat is with Mona Bami. Mona founded Revoke, a grassroots organisation that works with young refugees and asylum seekers. Revoke's radical edge is that it builds on Mona's own experience of migration and asylum to create an organisation that supports the whole person, instead of seeing a person seeking asylum as a housing client or a welfare recipient or a person in need of a food stamp. This organisation sees all of that combined. Revoke also stands apart because it sees its community as leaders that can agitate for their own change. In this conversation, we unpack how Revoke emerged out of Mona's life experience. Mona shares the model of activism shown to her by her parents in the struggle for a free Iran. And then how, as people seeking refuge in Denmark, that it was community networks that were so important in helping them to not only meet their basic needs, but to enact their desire for a better world. So, let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers UK episodes like this one are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the UCL Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. We are broadcast on Acast as part of the Iconoclast Network, so you can find us there as well as on all the usual podcast apps. You can find out more about Changemakers on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Hello, Mona. Welcome to Changemaker Chats.
Hey. Hi, Amanda.
It is my pleasure to have you with us today. I'm very excited by this conversation and exploring both your extensive heritage and sort of social change experiences, as well as your current work with Revoke. But as we always begin, I wondered if you could introduce yourself to our fantastic audience by talking a little bit about what kind of change maker are you?
It's an interesting title to be called, and feels like a lot to live up to for the next 50 minutes or so. But well, my name is Mona, and I'm currently the director of a nonprofit in London called Revoke. We work with young displaced people who come to the UK, well, I guess who come to London more specifically, and we do so in quite a holistic way, which I, you know, we'll get onto later. I set up Revoke about 2.5 years ago, following probably, I don't know, a decade or so in the social third sector of London. I guess prior to that, my childhood was also, I mean, definitely affected by displacement. My parents sought political asylum in Europe from Iran, and my life was kind of very much, my childhood was very much lived against this backdrop of activism and diaspora life and so on. So I guess that kind of set a bit of a tone for how I was trying to move forward as an adult.
Excellent. I mean, look, I love it I think that lots of us can be change makers, right? Like I might posit that everyone is able to be a change maker. But I think it's also true that you're a pretty remarkable one. And I'm very excited to understand the both this journey that you just briefly hinted at, sort of in part embodied by your parents, as well as your own experiences through different types of organizations, and then what you've settled on with Revoke. So let's open that conversation up. Right? So you've done all these different things, but why? You know, why this interesting path, Mona? Why did this emerge? Please go back as far as relevant, go back to the influences of those people who've really shaped you and the journey of migration that has shaped you to help you find the kind of work that you're now doing.
I guess it's been a mixture of, I don't know, gut instincts and a bit of chance and a bit of luck and a bit of accident and all those things that I guess all of our lives are. But yeah, my parents, like I mentioned, sought asylum in Denmark in 84 after the Iranian Revolution, the Revolution of 79. For people who don't know much about it, you may have seen Iran quite active in the news more recently in the last couple of years. And, you know, those kinds of uprisings in Iran have been happening sort of, you know, sporadically and intermittently over these last, you know, definitely 40 odd years, you know, since the revolution. But back then, that revolution was, like I think many uprisings across the Middle East, like a very genuine call for deep change. And actually, and you know, people have different opinions on this, but not actually a call for sort of Islamic power, like actually, you know, a call from citizens in that country for real social justice, and actually at a more radical level than I think we call for social justice a lot of the time here in Europe. But yeah, so it's considered quite, I think, a key moment in our more like contemporary history, and quite significant also for the history of the Middle East. But so my parents, who'd actually been to, let's call it the West, like America and Europe in their 20s, each of them separately to study, but had returned to Iran around that time, became very actively involved in that revolution, in those uprisings, like a lot of people did. And they stayed in Iran for about 3 years, both kind of at the height of the revolution and also as maybe it was not plateauing, but at some of the aftermath of like people trying to organize themselves and, you know, fight for, yeah, a radically different society. You know, there was a lot of like socialist and Marxist influences at that time. My parents were quite, my dad in particular was quite a sort of key figure in that movement. And so after remaining in Iran for, yeah, a few years in 82, somebody called Khomeini came into power, which, you know, created a much, much harsher crackdown than there already had been. Thousands of political prisoners were held. Thousands of people were executed and murdered in prisons in Iran, which again is something that maybe isn't talked enough about. And that was when my parents, amongst many of their comrades, like realized that they really needed to get out. And so my parents actually left Iran in 82 and spent 2 years traveling across Kurdistan before making it to Europe. Yeah. So
wow.
And those were sort of stories we actually heard about as children in probably quite downplayed, wistful ways of, you know, the stories of Kurdistan, which I now realize were probably really horrible. But, you know, to us as kids, they sounded kind of quite mystical. The 2 years that they'd lived in the deserts of Kurdistan and traveled around setting up camps and so on. But yeah, so in 84, I think they finally had made it to kind of Baghdad and then actually boarded. They were some of the people, you know, back from there, I guess, boarded planes to Europe. I mean, many people now come by foot and by boat and so on, right? But anyway, so they were granted asylum in Denmark, had to sort of change identities and be given quite high level of security protection. And so did many of the people they had been organizing with. And so I guess, I mean, I was born within a year and a half, 2 years of them having just settled in Denmark. So my childhood was very much spent against the backdrop of continued organizing that my parents were involved in, you know, still hoping for change back home in Iran. I might leave that there actually, because I feel like that has been quite long.
Oh no, how extraordinary. And, you know, I don't normally explore some of this stuff on the podcast. It's about you, but I'm fascinated by Iran, having read, you know, a lot about the history. I've been to Iran.
Oh, wow. That's more than me.
Well, yeah, maybe it's not safe.
No, exactly.
But that history, I think that is so, it is so true. I mean, from my perspective, and I am a white mega outsider, but that interaction of the sort of radical protest that was going on in 79 was so apparent in what I've read, at least. That's fascinating. Your parents, just to both note how extraordinary that they were so involved in those movements. I mean, they were extraordinary movements. And I can only imagine that sort of legacy experience for having been so involved in that movement, to have had that sense of hope that your country might change, mm-hmm. Because the Shah who had been there previously was corrupt. Mm-hmm. It was a puppet state. It was a very, very deeply problematic environment. You have this hope of this transformation, and then it doesn't come off mm-hmm. in the way that you dreamed it could. I can only imagine how that then sort of inspired what they, or had a legacy in what they then took forward in their work in Denmark. Tell us how I don't know, that experience then shaped them, but also shaped you and what you learned from what they did as you were growing up.
Yeah, well, and it's really interesting because obviously I can maybe now reflect on their lives quite differently to what I maybe understood them to be at the time, right? And as you say, people continue to live with that hope for quite a long time before they maybe go, oh, okay, our lives are probably now being spent in Europe and that's that, because for some time, and I think this is a misunderstanding that many people even have now about people who seek asylum here, is that it's really planned for them, that it's some kind of, really orchestrated project. And a lot of the time it's an emergency solution and they actually hope that it will be temporary, for how much we all think they're dying to be here to claim our really poor benefits and stuff. Like actually people are kind of hoping to return a lot of the time. But with my parents, a lot of the people they had fled with also settled either just across the border in Sweden, which is another country, but very close, at least the southern part of Sweden, you can get to in like an hour, or also in Denmark, some of them in Germany. And they very much, like I said, continue to remain as a movement, And I guess, it's interesting because my parents would have been actually younger than I am now when this was happening. And so sometimes when I look at even just the work I'm doing, I can't imagine doing that whilst also having young kids. But anyway, they did that in a brand new country where they were learning Danish, where you have to like get settled and understand the infrastructure of this new place, not on very little money. But there was, And I don't think I'm romanticizing this, actually. There was such an energy within them and around me that I think, even when I was too young to really understand what that was, that's obviously been shaping us. Deep sort of radical spirit. They never really had 9-to-5s. They were studying a bit. They learned Danish. They did some freelance work. My mom did translation work, My dad would write, our home was just this kind of activist hub, and people continued to meet there and have meetings and organize from there. And, I remember if I ever woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't sleep, I'd almost always find my dad sitting and writing. So he was still writing articles. As I got a little bit older, my mum was producing a kind of Farsi women's rights magazine that was being kind of written and almost like published from our home. And then a bit further along in time, they started recording radio from our house that was broadcast across Iran. So like political radio broadcasts. And so my home felt so different to the, kids I'd meet at school and go play with.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was a sense that I guess as a kid, I sort of knew that. I didn't quite, I knew it was different. I knew when people asked, oh, what do your parents do? I found it a really hard question to answer when everybody else would say, my parent is a teacher or a, whatever they might be.
My parent is a revolutionary activist who didn't really work out, but now they're still keeping it alive.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was always a bit of a sort of, maybe a bit of a double life, actually. Like there was a sense of like, you go out into the world and it's also very clearly marked as a kid by this is where we speak Danish and then at home we speak Farsi. There are some really clear markers of like differences that you're moving between. And then I did actually from the age of when I started school, and in Denmark you start school later. So when I started school from 6, I did actually go to this very alternative, democratic, kind of slightly hippie-ish school. I guess maybe the closest resemblance would be a Steiner school perhaps. So I actually continued, my schooling experience in Copenhagen was also quite different to anything I experienced when I moved to the UK. But I guess that continued to uphold some of those values, and I was embedded in them quite strongly, but even by Danish kind of standards. And then, yeah, when I was about 12, quite suddenly to me at least, it seemed, we were moving. My parents told me that they decided to move to the UK. And I guess the key thing to note here is, and that's 14 years after they'd arrived in Denmark, thinking it was probably going to be a brief pit stop. But I guess the key differences that had happened in that time is that they'd gotten Danish citizenship and the EU had formed. And so suddenly they were able to maybe be a bit more intentional about where they might want to live, rather than just being in this small country of about 5 million people, you know, with a pretty difficult language and a very homogenous kind of culture. And I think they had some hopes that the UK would at least bring them a bit more into a more cosmopolitan and international space. But I later learned that they also had some fears that they had potentially been tracked by the Iranian government.
Oh, wow.
And that also triggered maybe the desire to move. But yeah, so anyway, I moved to the UK as a teenager, unfortunately not to London, which they'd hoped. We couldn't afford that. So it was kind of in Hertfordshire, which was horrible, and it just as homogenous and white. And anyway, but this constant double life of feeling like I was in this radical activist hub at home and then going out to school and behaving quite normal and sort of, you know, trying to fit in was quite like a constant process. But I mean, yes. So I guess, you know, going back to the why, I almost sometimes feel like I don't know what else I could have done. You know, like there is something in that energy, like I said, in the way that it kind of enters you almost by like osmosis. You know, if that's all you've known, if you don't have an experience of people going to a 9-to-5 office job, you know, if all, you know, I felt like I knew the words for revolution before I knew like nursery rhymes. And, you know, there's just a sense that I guess when I did become a young adult, if anything, there was this quite existential difficulty of like, well, there is not a revolution on my doorstep. And I don't really know now how I apply all this energy and these beliefs and these values into the society that I'm in. Like, what does that look like? I guess was
in a sense, like how you take what you learned at home into your new public environment in the United Kingdom, perhaps, you know, which is an extraordinary thing because most of us learn our politics out of the home, but you've learned it in the home, but it's a different kind. Well, like I really hear you when you say you've sort of seen this activation that happens in your parents' life that you're a part of that's kind of created this sense of hope, but then where to apply it in this new environment becomes a challenge. Okay, so here's the question then. Great. So you have a sense of of this energy and this question about where to apply it. So what do you do? Where do you seek out to explore this question of change? Like where do you try? Where do you go and try to do that?
I mean, I don't want to tangent too deeply into this, but I guess a very key thing that actually also happened to me is that when I was 16, we were in the UK by this point, my dad actually died. And my dad having been like a very, very key figure, I mean, both my parents, but I mean, I really did have a very, very, I was the oldest child, had a very close connection to him. He'd been a real driver for me, especially as a girl, actually, as his only daughter, proper push to be like, you're going to play football and, you know, you're going to pick up the guitar and you're going to, I don't know, you know, there is like nothing you can't do. And that's kind of that. And so, yeah, I guess that had started shaping me in my young adult life. My brothers were quite a bit younger than me. I had already, from my sort of A-levels onwards, been in a role where I was helping my mum at this point raise my younger siblings. And so that was a huge shift as well in our home environment. And my mum, who very much continued political organizing, was in many ways still very, of course, like destroyed and defeated. And I think also when you have lived in exile, when you're not near your family, your relatives, like your familiar environment. At this point, we'd only been in the UK for about 3-4 years. So again, getting to know another country and then having this one person you've done it with all the time and then, you know, they're not there. And so, yeah, so there was a sense that I think I very much had this feeling of like, right, you know, social justice, how does that apply? There was a bit more at this point, a pragmatism as well, of feeling like I needed to sort of, get a job, you know, get a good job and maybe support even financially a bit, or at least that was a feeling I had in me, whether that was completely correct or not. I happened to be quite academic, so it wasn't, you know, I ended up doing a philosophy degree in London and kind of at least doing that academic path, and then came out of that degree, mostly political philosophy mostly. And yeah, I guess like most young people in this society, I was sort of, I guess, forced to just look at the charity sector really, you know, like if I wanted to earn a salary, and I did, and I, you know, didn't, obviously at 21, 22, you know, I didn't know loads about it, but I just kind of, I actually did have a level of drive in me that I look back now and think that was interesting, but I literally started kind of blitzing, you know, like sending so many applications, writing to organizations, asking to come in, asking to shadow, asking to intern, whatever. And I guess in some shape or form that paid off.
You had the energy.
I had the energy. I had quite like a, yeah, I definitely had a drive.
And a determination given what had happened with your father.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But what I maybe would say is that maybe if that hadn't happened, I could have seen myself actually already then potentially doing something even more radically, politicized. But there was a feeling of it needing to take the form of a paid job, definitely.
Yeah. It makes total sense.
So I did, you know, I did some think tanks, I did some mainstream charity work. And then I actually, at the age of 26, very surprisingly, got seconded into the Cabinet Office here in the UK. This is a central government.
That's very fancy
department.
Of you. Well done.
Yeah. which was actually one of the first times I remember being really confronted again with this double life, because they had to do security checks on me. And I remember having to fill out forms about my parents' even identities.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It was almost like all of a sudden you had to disclose.
Yeah, and
isn't that interesting? Wow. What was that like?
I have to say, you know, at 26 and maybe not knowing the weight or the danger of these things, it was definitely this feeling I'd regularly have growing up of like, you know, people are going to, you know, because I'd grown up actually, you know, being in a playful way guided by my parents to be like, oh, you know, how about we don't tell people exactly where we live, or how about when we go to this place and there are other Iranians that we don't know, maybe we pretend that we live here and, you know, that we have this name, and, you know, already
they kept you safe.
Yeah, they really kept us safe in a way that I look back now and find really, you know, incredible, actually.
Oh, it's so moving.
But so I'd grown up like, essentially, like telling cover-ups and not fully knowing that I was, and different names and different places, and even the name I do have comes from, like, you know, comes from a different identity. It's not actually my, you know, the original surname that my lineage of my family have, and so on, because that had to be changed when my parents got their asylum. But anyway, so I'm sort of faced with this, you know, Cabinet Office screening form that literally asks on it, you know, have your parents ever held another name? And, you know, and the point is, when you're given a new name for protection, you're not supposed to say you have a new name for protection. So you actually say, no, they've never held another name, you know, which is,
yeah.
So this had to, all of this. And I spent a year at the age of 26 in central government. And it was actually it was just after we'd moved, not that I think the most, you know, the new Labour government was potentially anything particularly radical, but it was literally just after it had changed from a Labour government to the coalition government in 2010 in the UK, where I entered the Cabinet Office a couple of years later, but it was under a sort of Tory-led, you know, coalition government. Mm-hmm. So that was probably a really, really key turning point, because, you know, I get offered the job. It obviously feels like something to take, you know, it's impressive and it's quite well paid and it's, you know, whatever. And in this, you know, anyone I speak to is like, wow. And, you know, there's no space to question whether this is what I should be doing. And I think that was when I on such a visceral level would go to work every day and kind of feel out of sorts in a very deep way.
And why do you think, tell us why you think that? I mean, I can understand, but tell us, I think it's fascinating. You also felt like there wasn't space to think about it because everyone was telling you, oh, congratulations, you're doing the right thing. What made you feel so out of sorts?
It was on such a kind of raw, like core level, you know, I think I'd, you were in a space that thinks that it's doing good things, you know, I guess civil society and central government, and it's supposed to be the place that like runs the country, and it's the height of civilization, and it has all the brightest brains of our society, although most many of them happen to just be in kind of white male heads at that point. and also, you know, up not just that, but, you know, kind of very middle class, like educated brains. I remember in my first week or so there, like somebody coming up to me and going, oh, you're the one who always wears such bright scarves. And I was like, wow, like I'm kind of being observed as a sort of exotic animal in this place.
Wow.
And yeah, it's people, it was this feeling that everybody was, nobody seemed like they had any opinions, you know? I mean, I guess that's the whole point of the civil service, right? So you're dealing with subjects you can't really not have opinions about. Like, I think it would be different if maybe you were, I don't know, doing like maybe engineering or something. You could still have opinions, but you know, you're dealing literally with issues of like education and poverty and, you know, health and
lives, people's lives.
And everyone does it in this kind of like neutral robotic way where they are basically like calculating people's lives on spreadsheets. You know, you sit in meetings where somebody's quite casually like, okay, well, I guess I'll just change this row and then we take a million from here and put it here. And, you know, it's just, it was the strangest thing for me because I'd only ever heard those subjects talked about in the absolutely most like, you know, fiery, invigorated way. You couldn't talk about social issues without, especially Iranians, raising their voices and flapping their hands around and, you know, it being so animated. And suddenly I was in a space where people with a straight face might just be like, okay, well, I guess, you know, we just cut this, don't we? And we just, you know, and I just, yeah, I actually just couldn't understand. On a very sort of like deep level, I just don't think my body could comprehend it. And I actually remember on a couple of occasions walking out of our team meetings, you know, going to the toilet and would find myself bursting into tears and not really being able to fully even probably articulate to myself why I was suddenly standing and crying in the middle of the day at work when nothing had seemingly happened. So anyway, I did a year there. And when that particular contract was coming to an end and potentially could have been renewed or whatever, I decided to leave. And that was about 3 years into my so-called like more professionalized career in the sector. And I took a punt and I had some savings and I left without having another job, but happened to be living in quite a cheap house share at the time in London and had enough contacts that I sort of had this gut feeling that I could probably pick up some freelance work at this point. And that was that. And that was in 2014. That was 10 years ago. Yeah. And I guess that kind of marked a shift. I started trying to find and engage with more grassroots work in London. I was freelancing a bit in the more mainstream sector just to kind of keep an income coming in. And yeah, that took me on a journey of engaging with much smaller, like radical organizing projects. I got quite actively involved in the aftermath of the London riots and some of the organizing that was happening around raising awareness of police brutality. I ended up in some racial justice organizing kind of spaces. And then eventually in 2016, I went to Calais.
Right. And so I think some of our audience will completely understand when you say, I went to Calais. You know, yeah. The place where the refugees were coming across. Others, you know, maybe who are in other parts of the world. Yeah. I'm sitting here in Australia. Plenty of people here are not going to know what happened there.
Wine. Yes.
They might get very confused about what's going on. It's France. It could be really elegant. Tell us about your experience there. And in particular, I guess I invite you to tell us how it helped you come to the place of setting up Revoke.
Yeah.
Like how that journey drew you to Revoke.
So Calais is, well, it's actually not a recognized refugee camp. This is quite like a key. So the border of Calais is basically where people travel across Europe right to the tip of Calais to try and get to the UK. It's where you would cross the channel to come to the UK. Back in 2015, 2016, at some point, there was up to maybe sort of like 9,000 or so people just living in essentially what you'd call a makeshift kind of shanty town on the border of Calais. There were volunteers and, you know, very like grassroots entities there, like setting up infrastructure, helping distribute food and whatever. But Calais, unlike most refugee camps across the world, it was not recognized, like, let's say, by the UN or whatever, as a refugee camp, meaning there was also no formal like NGO infrastructure there at all. It was quite an interesting phenomenon here in Europe because it really was a kind of, it gets cited as a bit of an example of, I don't know what you want to call it, like people power or whatever, because so many young people, especially from the UK, just got up, own money, you know, own cars, own time, whatever, and just went there to try and do something. And by no means was that perfect at all. It was messy. It was chaotic. It was all the things that it is when you, I guess, maybe have less structures in place somewhere, but it was also the closest I'd seen to this kind of like maybe radical spirit in action, maybe since my childhood, this feeling that people are doing it because they just can't not do it because they find it brutal and devastating and unjust. And because they're just looking at it and going, how is our world so messed up that this is taking place? And I may not know what I'm doing, but I'm here, right?
I'm not observing this. I'm going to do what I can. Type of.
And again, there's a lot of problematicness to that. 100%. You have 24-year-olds, maybe just, I don't know, like who with no experience, no one, I don't know, whatever, going out and trying to help, you know, thousands of very traumatized people. Like it's so far from perfect, but then that's the world we live in. Right. So basically my brother called me one day and said, you know, I'm going to help take like a car of stuff. I think he maybe did one journey without me and then came back and said, there are so many Farsi speakers there. There are Iranians and Afghans and, you know, they really need Farsi translators in the camp. And that's kind of what did it, because before that I had maybe felt a bit like I didn't want to be, I don't know, maybe another person who immediately just jumped and went there and didn't really know what was needed. So anyway, my brother and I maybe over the space of 6 months did about six or so brief trips back and forth to kind of help with translation. And I guess the short version is that I kind of started feeling a bit like, okay, this is not maybe the most sustainable to keep going to Calais. And for people listening, again, London is actually on the southern part of the UK. And actually it takes about 2 hours to get to Calais, even though it's a different country. So it's not actually as epic as it sounds. You know, you can do it in a day. You just have to cross the channel. That was when... And in the time we were going as well, that camp got demolished, you know, by police multiple times. It got dispersed. You know, a lot of the infrastructure was ruined. A lot of people lost a lot of hope. And so, yeah, I guess I returned from there feeling like, well, if what everyone is there for is to try and get to the UK and people are arriving into the UK, then what is actually happening here when people arrive? And maybe it's a bit more feasible and sustainable for me to do something that's here. I was reflecting a lot on kind of, you know, how do you preserve that, again, like that radical energy, that compassion, that humanity that was out there, but put it into a bit more of a intentional framework. I don't necessarily even know if I want to use the word structure, but you know, like a bit more aligned and intentional framework. And yeah, it still wasn't an immediate result in Revoke. There were a few detours of getting involved in migration related work in London, but eventually after the lockdown that we have after COVID and lockdown, where a lot more recognition of grassroots work, I think, was actually kind of had in society here. There was a sense that that was more the way that you could address certain things as opposed to in really large institutions. But Revoke was set up 2.5 years ago in 2021. And with, yeah, let me sort of think about essentially, no, go on.
Well, I can ask you a question. You don't need to think of it all on your own. So, I mean, I guess that you set up this thing called Revoke that had learnt from these sort of waves of lessons, you know, throughout from your personal life and then in your public life. I mean, to start, tell us what it is. Like, what does Revoke do? Like, what's distinct about it?
So we're a nonprofit organisation. We're not a charity, like, you know, very specifically, and there are many reasons for that, but partly that it's quite hard to do more politicized social justice work in a charitable incorporation. So we're sort of, you know, another corporate incorporation that allows us to still fundraise and stuff, but to be more independent. And we work with young displaced people. So I guess mainly young people that arrive alone. They're not all minors. We do work most, in fact, a lot of them are young adults. They're over 18. But the idea, you know, the sort of main focus is they come alone. They've left their home countries probably as minors in a lot of cases, even if by now they're over 18. And they sort of aren't in a unit and maybe a bit more of like a family unit. And there is this feeling that, you know, they're still at this stage in their lives where there's so much nurture they need, you know, where there is so much, I guess, to like learn. And, you know, if they'd been back in their own countries, they would have probably completed some kind of education. Hopefully they might have had, they would have hopefully had parents and guardians and elders and whatever, but they sort of arrive here like in those formative years, totally unsupported. And one of the key observations I'd had when sort of spending some time in the sector before setting up Revoke was that they get bounced around all the different kind of services that we have here in a completely sort of unjoined up way. So they might have a social worker, they might have an immigration lawyer, they might go somewhere to college where they have, I guess, a sort of teacher that sees them sometimes. And then they might need to go somewhere else to get food tokens. And then they go, I don't know, they go somewhere else for housing advice. And actually, all of these elements of their lives, like they intersect, obviously, right? I mean, they don't just intersect emotionally, but they might even intersect very practically and legally. Like there are implications in each of them that affect the other. And none of these professionals are talking, you know, their social worker never speaks to their immigration lawyer. And some, you know, sometimes, you know, something as simple as they maybe even get a fine or something, some sort of petty crime or something happens in their life because of how destitute they are, which would affect their immigration case. But, you know, again, the immigration lawyer doesn't know, or, you know, nothing has been joined up for them. And the frustration and the anger and the kind of desperation that builds up in them when they're just bouncing around, retelling their story to all these different professionals is immense. And so I guess one of our main aims was we want to work with them holistically. Like we want to be the link between all of these services. Like they need an advocate. They don't have, again, like a parent or something like that. And there needs to be somebody that translates and communicates to all these different services who this human is as a sort of entire entity. So one was the holistic element. And then the other was that I very much felt that migration and displacement are political issues. You can't work on them in a sort of apolitical way. Like to just say, we give clothes, we give food, we're nice to people, but we don't challenge the Home Office that's making their lives miserable. You know, we don't challenge like the border regime. We don't challenge the policies that put people in this place. To me, felt nonsensical. So I guess those are the distinctions. Like there is a political edge to how we work. And we aim to work with a young person holistically when they come into our care.
And it's, I want to get into that in a little bit more. Like, I'd love to know what it looks like in practice. It does strike me the holistic approach, apart from just being ridiculously sensible, it also sounds like the kind of the experience you had in your home where people were coming in and doing all these different things, this hub, this activist hub where that you describe in Denmark in particular, where everyone was coming into this space. It's the opposite of I'm going here to see a social worker, and then I'm going there to see a teacher. Like it's, you know, this sort of opposites between connection and disconnection in how we see ourselves and how, you know, your family obviously had a very difficult time, but they had a community, especially when you were younger in Denmark. There was a massive community, and that was such a big part of how they were able to feel connected, feel strong, all that sort of stuff. It seems to me that in creating holistic care, there is a sort of sense of community creation as well that seems so important, especially for people who are dislocated. It's important for everyone. It's particularly important here.
Definitely. And I guess for me, you know, even on a very practical micro level, what it meant was that I had this whole community of people whose houses I could just go into, and we'd just, you know, I don't know, go and help ourselves from the fridge, and we'd be looked after by all these different adults. If there was a political meeting, then they would take turns to be like, who's playing with the kids in the other room while we're sort of having an important meeting. And I guess in an actually completely not fluffy way, like, to me, that is practicing the values of, let's say, like a socialist society or something. Like, for me, there was a feeling of we're sharing resources. We are working within the means that we have. There is a huge load of compassion going around for everybody in this space. And I don't think you're able to really fight for these grand political concepts if you haven't felt them. Like, if you don't know what they would feel like, a lot of, you know, then they're just intellectual things. And that's also, you know, it's a good enough start, I guess. But for me, there was something about, you know, of course it's wrong that like a young person's life is fragmented in this way. And also actually that you can't change just one element of somebody's like destitution. I mean, if you want to get into the root of that destitution and you look at sort of capital, like you can't just be like, oh, it's just housing that's an issue or it's just immigration. You know, these things are deliberately linked. And once somebody is disadvantaged in one of them, they're usually disadvantaged in all of them. And so you can't just like pick and choose where you address it from. Mm. So for us, that was a big part of it. We really wanted, as you say, to kind of bring one thing we very much do is we want to bring the young people along in that kind of mobilizing and advocacy process. So maybe the way it usually works is they find us, they come to us, we make sure we're dealing with their basic needs first. Like if they don't have housing or if they don't even have an immigration lawyer or whatever, then obviously those are the absolute most immediate things that have to be dealt with. Then you might say, okay, do they also need some therapy or, you know, something needed to kind of allow them to live a richer and healthier life here in the UK.
And allow them to lead their own life rather than have it pointed at by someone else.
Exactly. And so once we feel that those things are in place, and we often very quickly see quite a shift in a person once they're seen and heard and valued and respected, funnily enough, then a big part of what we do is sort of political education, like bringing them along in that advocacy process where they might start to not just advocate for themselves, but also for others, like where we eventually get them to maybe like actually take on kind of peer roles and, you know, coming along in that movement essentially and connecting them to the wider social movements that would help make change in their lives.
Amazing. And so are they actually after sort of having though being able to invest in control of their own life because their sort of crisis needs are supported, they then can play a leadership role in their communities, the life of their community.
Yeah.
It sounds like a very sensible approach. Part of me wonders, you know, like this is something that's quite distinctive in your journey that's helped create this extraordinary journey. It also strikes me that if only there weren't more people doing this, like what makes this kind of practice, what do you think gets in the way of this kind of deeper practice happening in the sector? Like, and yeah, let's first start with that. Like, why do you think this isn't more widespread?
I mean, honestly, I think it's because the system is set up, our societal system is set up in a way that doesn't want that to happen. Like, you know, we have the UK, I mean, many countries, but I'm just going to speak about the UK, has literally, like as in our politicians themselves, not just us on the outside, have coined our asylum system as like the hostile environment. They want it to be hostile. It is designed to be difficult. They don't want to make it easy for people to organize against them. And our third sector, let's call it that, or our charity sector very broadly, is usually fairly like aligned within those systems.
And well, they're often funded by
often
those.
Funded, you
like
know,
often funded. Not always, of course, but
you know, there is a sense that okay, like we need to perhaps be seen to be quite civilized in somewhere like the UK. You know, the image of us is that we're supposed to be democratic and we're supposed to be civilized. So let's at least make it look like there is a bit of a support from us for asylum seekers. And I guess we can't literally maybe have people like dying on the streets too blatantly. So let's have some food and some services, but they kind of are working in alignment with each other. And if our if the dominant, let's say, like if the dominant powers or, you know, voices in our society wanted a good life for those seeking asylum here, then they just wouldn't even have the asylum system that we have. You know, they wouldn't have the border controls that we have. They wouldn't spend over £1 billion on like drones and surveillance technology of our borders. They would just put that billion into the welfare state. You know, like these things are conscious and deliberate. And so if you truly are working in a way that challenges that, that's going to be difficult. I guess one of the absolutely most obvious ways that makes it difficult is resources. I have a team of, we're 6 part-time staff. We help, you know, something like 70 young people kind of, you know, in most, you know, whatever, in the flow of things come and go into our service, that, you know. And like, we could probably, I mean, if we could probably keep it, you know, in terms of need, we could keep expanding and keep expanding. But I mean, so resources are a huge one. And therefore, for all of people's best will in the world, like we're human. And so if resources are limited, even just on a very human level, like people will burn out, they will maybe lose hope, they will become exhausted, you know, they will potentially stay in this line of work for a few years and need to leave. You know, there is a lot you're battling against, essentially. And I just don't think that we live in a culture at the moment that truly promotes compassion, collectivism. It does everything it can to kind of, I don't know, to like suck that out of you, I think. And I think you have to be quite strong in yourself to keep pushing back against that and finding other ways around it.
So the thing I just keep thinking is, this is so hard. How do you find the energy to keep doing it? Like, where does your energy to do this difficult work against such difficult odds? Where do you source that from?
Well, it comes and goes, and it has been sourced from different places at different times. Last year, as soon as Revoke maybe felt like it was somewhat stable, and I'd kind of, you know, I don't know, pushed through the first year and a half of it, I did collapse and I was off work for 2 months with what was really extreme burnout. So I am by no means like, I don't know, immune. I would say that it really does come a lot of the time from the people around me. I do feel I have a very, very strong network of people around me, be that friends or comrades or people I work with, of course, my family. But there is a sense that we connect over this and, you know, you show each other care and you are able to kind of hold each other through these really difficult times. You know, before Christmas, a young person that I'd known for about 4 years and that we'd supported at Revoke committed suicide because of the fact that his life in the UK had been just consistently made so difficult in the time that he'd been here. So you can't get through that without like a solid network of people around you. But I actually feel that when you share such deep values, and this is what I saw kind of growing up, you know, when your friendships or your relationships with people go a bit beyond just we meet up, we hang out, we have coffee, you know, when you're working on something together, when you have a shared vision, it makes the bonds incredibly deep. And I think it makes the relationships a lot of the time a lot deeper. And in a weird way, I actually think it still somehow ends up being preferable to not having these hard things to do, but then maybe also not having those deep bonds, actually. So I think it's the people. And yeah, I don't know, on an organizational level, we've worked quite hard to implement things like some budget for well-being and making sure staff also get therapy and making sure that we sometimes like make time for collective like retreats and reflective practice and art therapy and, I don't know, the things that I guess we also have for the young people.
Exactly. It sounds like you're prefiguring or modelling this culture of care at so many different levels in the work. It sounds really hard, and I honour you being open to share how hard it's personally been for you. It sounds extremely hard, but it also does sound that you are, I don't know, eyes open, facing that, and working out what, you know, there is hard things in the world. How can we support each other to be able to eyes open, sit with that, be with that, not fall over and not, you know, but to care for each other when things are hard.
And honestly, like, I say this, you know, especially after, let's say, like lockdown, I don't know, like a lot of people were forced to really rethink, you know, what life's about and what they're doing with their 8-9 hours a day, every day. And I don't know if I think it's any easier to be in a, I'm going to be quite harsh, like a sort of meaningless job, or, you know, I don't know if I think it's actually an easier kind of life to get up every day and sit in like a sterile office and not feel connected to the, your colleagues that maybe you have to spend that much of your time with. Or I don't know. I don't know if I think that's easier, actually. Like for me, it's hard, but it's never actually felt like the less desirable choice. I'm not going to paint myself as a some kind of altruistic martyr only. Like I feel better for living in this way. And honestly, I feel most people that join and see it. I mean, we get a lot of requests from people who actually like have a, maybe seemingly a fairly good life going for themselves, of wanting to get involved, because I think it shows them something that is so human and so intrinsic to like, yeah, just what our like humanity is, that I think when people see it, it's hard to go back, actually.
Yeah. It's what can give us meaning. Mm-hmm. Like, and actually, a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to find meaning in places that aren't going to help. But this kind of work, I don't do your work, but I do other work. I find the greatest of meaning in being able to look at the problems we face collectively and do something about it, and not look away. So my final question for you is just to simply reflect on. So, you know, you've told us a lot about your journey and what you're doing now. How has this work you're doing now changed you? How has it changed you?
I think it's given me a lot of perspective. Like I said before, you know, it's both given me energy and it's taken energy at different times, but it's given me some of the most, yeah, like meaningful, I think, kind of human relationships like that I have. Doing Revoke specifically has definitely made me a bit better at kind of not just bulldozing and thinking quite short term and just like, I don't know, like blasting at things, but actually getting a bit better at kind of longer term thinking, the understanding that these things, as I think probably my parents maybe understood, are potentially for life, or at least you have to be able to kind of, you know, I've never been very good at looking that far down the line. And I think I've had to become a little bit better at imagining how something might evolve and change many, many times over. I've become more okay with things not working or not being perfect, given that we are in an imperfect world and we're trying to do the best that we can. Yeah. I think I've become more patient, weirdly, even though there are so many more things you see that could make you very impatient and very angry. But yeah, I maybe weirdly think I'm now in a place where it's maybe given me a bit more calm, and that, yeah, I'm sort of accepting that I'm probably slightly in it for the long haul, really. And, you know, my mom now in her late 60s, which is a very sometimes quite sad thing to hear when she sort of says, you know, we did think maybe back then we'd see change in our lifetimes, and now I'm not sure, and it feels like it's getting further and further away. But yeah, that's maybe not the most optimistic note to end it on, but yeah, I think I have found some kind of peace with how to potentially maybe run a marathon rather than a sprint.
Yeah, and knowing what you can do. Mm-hmm. Like we're not in control of what's going to happen with the government in here or there. You know, we should try, but when, you know, as individuals, we can make a contribution, but there are lots of things that we can do in our practice that we have we have a lot more control and capacity over, like how we do the work, how we listen to others, how we build connection, how we treat each other holistically, how we model the practice that we care about, how we hold up the energy that we see, all those things that you've described to me, what I hear in your story is treasuring the things that we can change, mm-hmm. is really important part of being an effective change maker.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I'm still, you know, trying to work on the macro stuff as much as absolutely possible. But I think I couldn't do it if I didn't also at least now see some micro like achievements, you know, when you do work in such a, I don't know, like frontline person-centered way, you see a lot of horror, but you also see some actual tangible change that you've made in somebody's life. And yesterday I was given a lift home from a social event we were organizing from a young person who I met when he was 16 in the social care system. And now he has a council house and he's learned to drive and he's gotten into uni and he was like, I'm going to drive you home because you've, you know, driven us so many times. And I don't know, that was probably the closest I'll come to sort of parental pride, I think, in my life. But that also feels like, okay, like somebody, you know, you are making, there is some change happening in at least some people's lives.
It's true, right? There's big and small change, and it's important to treasure them both. Thank you, Mona. This has been such a delightful conversation. I feel like we've traveled across continents as well as across the story of your work. It's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you so much, Amanda.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. This is Series 8, so there's plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. Changemakers audio producer is Jules Walker. We are broadcast on Acast and are part of the Iconoclast Network. Changemakers UK episodes, like the one you've just heard, is sponsored and supported by the Civic Power Fund and works with the UCL Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads at Changemakers Podcast. We are occasionally there on Twitter/X at Changemakers99, and I'm occasionally there too at Amanda Tatts. And you can check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.